Episode 11 of IBC Podcast.
Welcome to the Integrated Bilingual Counseling Podcast, where you will learn topics related to your well-being, emotions, marriage, relationships, parenting, immigration, and more. And now your host, Jose Villafuerte, and co-host, Myra Aguirre.
Hello, everyone. Hoping that everybody's doing okay. This is Jose Villafuerte, the host of this your weekly podcast show. And unfortunately, today we don't have Myra, our co-host. She's going to be away for a few weeks, and we're hoping that she's be back as soon as possible. And let's jump in. Today's episode is on immigration and the laws here in the United States. And for that, we have invited a special guest. Her name is Tess Regan. She's an attorney who specializes on immigration. But before we proceed to the interview we had with Attorney Regan, I'd like to say a few things about her education and about her career. So, Attorney Regan received her Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration from the University of Colorado. She then pursued a Juris Doctorate from the New England Law School. This is in Boston. She actually graduated from there with high honors, magna cum laude. Her practice has included work with the United Nations and also religious organizations, where she has focused on the representation of victims of domestic violence, human trafficking, child abandonment, immigration cases. Currently, she's working here in Connecticut, and she is very passionate about the protection and advancement of immigrant rights. So without any further ado, let me introduce you to the interview we had with Attorney Regan just a few days ago. So hello, everyone. Here we are from the offices of Esperanza Center for Law and Advocacy. And I'm accompanied by Attorney Tess Regan. And thank you very much, Tess, for taking the time to do this. We really appreciate it. I think that you're going to bring a lot of light into the topic of immigration and what is currently happening in our community. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, we did a brief intro of who you are and what you've been doing in our communities. Is there anything else that you like to add?
No, I think you summed it up pretty well.
Good. Yes, I mean, it's amazing your career. And why don't we just jump right into the topic? And the topic of today is immigration and law. So I would like to ask you, from a legal perspective, what is the definition of an undocumented alien here in the United States?
Sure. So I'll start by saying you do see alien a lot in the terminology used in the law, but it's a term as practitioners we actually don't like to use because we feel it dehumanizes our clients. So
Absolutely. We
would refer to it someone as an undocumented person or persons living without documentation.
Gotcha.
In the United States. And that kind of shifts the emphasis off the fact that someone is not permanently undocumented. You hear the term illegal alien a lot as well. Well, a person is illegal.
Yes.
Right? But what it actually means to be living without documentation. It's complicated in a sense because under the law, you have things like maybe you have unlawful presence in the United States, which mm-hmm. means time without status, mm-hmm. versus maybe time where you are not accruing this unlawful presence. You're allowed to be here, but you don't actually have a form of status. It's mm-hmm. something we see. So it can be kind of complicated because, for example, when you come here and seek asylum, the government's aware that you're here. You have a pending application. Sometimes you have work authorization. Mm-hmm. But you don't actually have a status.
Gotcha. So your status is pending, basically. Is that what it is?
Yeah. So you have an application in process, mm-hmm. but you don't have any lawful status at that time.
Okay.
So you can't say, I'm a green card holder. I'm a legal permanent resident. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen. I have temporary protected status. I'm an asylee. I'm a refugee. Those are all forms of status. You know, asylum seeker is not lawful status.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of these gray areas in the law mm-hmm. where maybe the government knows you're here, you're permitted to be here, but you have no real lawful status. It's something mm-hmm. like DACA, for example.
Right.
DACA is a classification. It's a, you've been given deferred action, but that's not a lawful status in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's...
That answers the question.
That answers the question or confuses the question a little
bit. So the fact that they have a deferred status means what exactly?
So for example, for DACA, DACA is a form of deferred action. Deferred action means the government is aware that you are here. They're permitting you to remain here for a certain specified period of time. They're not going to remove you during that time, mm-hmm. but you have not actually been given lawful status. DACA mm-hmm. is the most, I guess, well-recognized form of deferred action,
mm-hmm.
but there are other forms of deferred action that we used in the past. For example, it's one of the few things that you can apply for if you have a very serious medical condition or mm-hmm. your children have serious medical conditions mm-hmm. and you don't qualify for some other relief. Well, we used to be able to go to the field office and say, this is a very, very sympathetic situation. Here's a parent with a very sick child.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give them something for a set period of time? And it was typically 1 year, and it was called deferred action.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
will at least let them stay, work for 1 year, and then after a year, they have to renew it.
Gotcha. So the same thing happens with DACA. They have this deferred action that... lasts for maybe a year, a couple of years, and then the idea is that they have to renew it?
So DACA was a little bit different than how we had historically seen deferred action because it was done en masse, which deferred action in the scenario that I talked about was typically a case-by-case basis. So an mm-hmm. individual would come forward and say, here's my personal circumstances. Can you give me deferred action? DACA was different because it was a program done by President Obama under his executive action authority that extended this deferred action to a whole group of people, as opposed to individually saying, you can have it, you can have it, you can have it.
Right.
Of course, everyone had to apply and their cases were reviewed individually by an officer, but that was kind of a very different take on deferred action.
Mm-hmm.
And so what DACA actually was this executive action saying, okay, if you meet the certain criteria, if you came in at a certain age, if you've been here for a certain number of years, if you are currently in high school or have a high school diploma, then you can apply for this deferred action.
Mm-hmm.
It was initially granted for a period of 2 years, mm-hmm. at which time you could renew for another 2 years. Now, in 2014, President Obama tried to extend it, or what we called expanded DACA. He tried to expand the parameters a little bit more, so to take off some of the age limitations that were on the initial DACA, and he tried to change it so that you would be given a 3-year work permit as opposed to a 2-year work
mm-hmm.
permit. At the same time, he tried to implement a form of deferred action called DAPA, deferred action for parents,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, that didn't go
so
well.
Right.
You remember there was a Supreme mm-hmm. Court case on it, and ultimately the program was not allowed to move forward. And unfortunately, kind of got wrapped up in that was the expanded DACA. And so what you ended up having was an injunction that said, can't go forward until, you know, the court makes a decision on this. And so for a period of about two months, we were sending out all these DACA applications and we were getting work permits for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that injunction went into place, they had us saying, okay, all of those work permits that were granted for 3 years, if they were granted after this date, you have to send them back and we'll give you a 2-year one.
Okay, so that's what's happening with DACA. But now we know that with the new administration, they're in the process of revisiting that issue. And I think that when it said... they have a time frame until
right.
the Congress, I think,
so,
has to resolve it, right?
What happened now with this new administration is President Trump said, we're not going to have DACA anymore. We're going to cancel
mm-hmm.
the program.
Exactly.
And we will give you 1 month to renew applications. All the pending applications, we'll go ahead and adjudicate them. No new first-time applicants, which meant people who
mm-hmm.
were just turning 15 or something and were ready to file their DACA for the first time, they weren't allowed to apply anymore effective the date of the announcement. And 1 month was given to say, everyone whose DACA is going to expire within this period you have 1 month to file your application.
Right.
And after that 1 month, so that was up till October 5th, that's it. We're cutting everything off.
Wow.
And I'm going to put this in the hands of Congress now. If you want to do something with DACA, that's up to you guys.
Right.
Since that time, we've seen a number of laws proposed, some better than others.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert on those laws. There are some that are supported by the immigration legal community and mm-hmm. others that have some provisions attached to them that are actually quite harmful to mm-hmm. immigrants. So although they're purporting to be pro-DACA, they're attaching all these other harmful provisions to the laws.
Okay. So talking about DACA recipients, and just to wrap this up about DACA, what is that DACA recipients can expect next year?
Yeah, so a lot of it is unclear, right? I mean, some people were able to get their extensions. Some people have more time on their work permits, so they might not expire for a while. And those people have kind of another year, perhaps, of some semblance of security, I guess, in terms of not losing their jobs, mm-hmm. perhaps, or being able to remain in school. For some other DACA members, you know, a lot of my clients, they're going to be losing their work permits. They're going to expire. And that is, there's a lot of uncertainty with that. One of the scary things, I suppose, about DACA is these people voluntarily gave their information to the administration, and we don't know what the administration is going to do with it.
So does that mean that there is a possibility that now that the administration has their personal information, they become easy targets for the government to go and say, well, you're illegal here. You have to go back to your country.
Unfortunately, it does mean that. I would caution that with, because we don't want to create a panic, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sympathetic group of people. They mm-hmm. came as children. They've
right.
been educated here. Most of them have lived their whole lives here.
Correct.
It's not a popular group to start rounding up
right.
and removing. So I think that's the one thing going for the DACA group
right.
is that I think you'll see a lot more public pressure on the administration
mm-hmm.
if something like that were to happen. Of course, it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that's not going to happen.
Right,
but
right.
it could. I just think it would be very, very unpopular.
Yes, we got to keep our fingers crossed, mm-hmm. so basically, and hope that this won't happen and that Congress can do something about this.
Yeah.
Now, going back to our initial question.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're talking about people that are here in the United States that the government knows
mm-hmm.
of their presence. But what about those where the government doesn't know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge number of those people. And when we say the government doesn't know, we're talking about maybe immigration doesn't know
mm-hmm.
about them specifically. There are many people who enter the United States on visitor's visas or some form of visa and overstayed that visa.
Mm-hmm.
Now they don't have any status anymore. There's a record of their entry, but their whereabouts are unknown.
Right.
There are many individuals who crossed the border and were
mm-hmm.
undetected and had no encounters with immigration. And so those people, while they may have had contact with government in some way, whether it be a driver's license or an ITIN number or something like that,
mm-hmm.
they may have had no contact with immigration. So immigration
mm-hmm.
might not specifically know about them. And there are other people who crossed the border and did have contact with immigration at some point, and they received expedited removal orders, or
mm-hmm.
they have outstanding old removal orders that
mm-hmm.
a lot of them don't even know about. Those people are debatably a lot more at risk now
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
there is a record of them in the system. They do have these old orders outstanding. And if Immigration Customs Enforcement happens
mm-hmm.
to encounter them and find a record of them in the
mm-hmm.
system, they can be removed quite easily because they have an old existing
mm-hmm.
deportation order.
Mm-hmm.
The government might not have any record of where they are at this time,
mm-hmm.
but once they pick you up and take your fingerprints,
right.
you know, that record is in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are millions of people living here without any form of status, and they may be from any one of those categories or in any one of those situations.
So despite the fact that these folks don't have a legal status here in the U.S., does that mean that they don't have any rights? Or they have rights here?
Oh, they absolutely have rights. It's something I say to my clients all the time. Just because you don't have lawful immigration status does not mean you don't have any rights here.
Okay.
You still have many rights.
Such
your rights are limited in the sense that they're not to the full extent of a United States citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to exercise your rights when you're in this position because it's a very vulnerable position to be in. Often these people don't speak the language. They're very afraid of any form of law enforcement or government, and they don't realize they have any rights. So when the time comes for them to exercise them, they're not comfortable doing so.
Mm-hmm.
They're still protected by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if an ICE agent comes to your house and knocks on your door and wants to come into your home, they need a warrant to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
if you're undocumented, they still, mm-hmm. you know, the Constitution still applies. They can't just
mm-hmm.
barge in there, though the Supreme Court is mm-hmm. chipping away at mm-hmm. all of our rights to,
yes.
to some extent, in my opinion, to be honest. But mm-hmm. they have the right to say, do you have a warrant? And if that warrant's not signed by a judge, mm-hmm. you know, you can't come into my house. Mm-hmm.
So the warrant has to be signed by a judge. It can't just be signed by officer from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
So how most ICE warrants are done is they are administrative warrants, meaning they're just signed by someone within ICE. Yeah, within the department. To enter your home, they are supposed to be signed by a judge.
Okay. So the recommendation here is if there's ever an officer from ICE that goes to your home, knocks on your door, don't open the door.
Right. I mean, I would say you can speak through the door. What can I help you with?
Right.
We're looking for so-and-so. Okay, do you mm-hmm. have a warrant to come in the house?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have a warrant. Okay, please pass it under the door.
Right.
And then to look at that warrant and say, is this signed by a judge?
And that's in the event that the person behind the door speaks English.
Right.
Knows how to read English.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I usually tell my clients, look for the word juez, look for the word judge, see if you can sign it. But also, I mean, I would say 90%+ of these are not signed by a judge. So the likelihood that it is very, very rare. And the most important thing to remind them is not to consent to the search,
mm-hmm.
because that's the number one way they get into a home.
Yeah, that's giving
someone
them
opens
access.
The door,
right,
and they're intimidated, mm-hmm. and so they say, sure, okay, come in.
Right.
And you've just opened up your whole home to them.
Because it's an intimidating process mm-hmm. anyways to begin with. Now, what about somebody in the community? You know, let's say that you're driving your vehicle, you're mm-hmm. going to work. An officer pulls you over and says, documents. Usually what they mean by that is your driver's license, your registration.
Mm-hmm.
What if they ask you for a social security number?
So here in Connecticut, I'm relatively new to this state, but it's my understanding that there is a form of a trust act here in Connecticut, which means that local law enforcement is not ever supposed to inquire about your immigration status.
Mm-hmm.
So when they pull you over, they can ask for your driver's license, but they're not supposed to ask for proof of any form of lawful immigration mm-hmm. status.
Mm-hmm. And if they do? I mean, talking about rights, mm-hmm. what are our rights?
Yeah, it's a tough question because I'm sure it does happen, right? And if they do, I mean, if you feel comfortable saying it, say, it was my understanding that under the current law, you're not supposed to ask about immigration status. Mm-hmm. And I believe the police here know that. From my conversations with some of the police departments, New Haven Police Department, mm-hmm. they seem pretty clear that we don't ask ever.
Right.
But if they do and you don't feel comfortable saying that mm-hmm. and it comes out that you're not documented and then that information is used, is shared with ICE, that's also a violation
mm-hmm.
of the Trust Act. Mm-hmm. So at that point, once a lawyer gets involved, we would want to look at, okay, when did the violation occur? What's the remedy for that? Is there a remedy that we can seek for that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if somebody is accountable when that happens.
It's one of the difficult things with this administration, and it's one of the things I think we as lawyers are really trying to do, which is mm-hmm. make people accountable
right.
for these kind of actions. When there is a violation, how can we hold them accountable for that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult task,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's our job now in mm-hmm. the legal community especially as we see, not so much with local law enforcement in my experience so far here, but with federal immigration enforcement, we have to be holding them accountable for some of the things they're doing.
Exactly. I think that's the right thing to do, hold others accountable for this. Well, now let me ask you this last question. You're an attorney that specializes on immigration. Since the new administration, have you seen an increment of cases on your caseload?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that the reasoning behind that is multifold, which is almost immediately what we saw was a lot of fear in the community. And so that automatically bumps up your workload because mm-hmm. what I had happen almost immediately, you know, the travel ban, the first proposed travel ban mm-hmm. went into effect. And even though there were only 7 countries affected mm-hmm. at that time, I had every single client probably call me.
Wow.
All of them. My phone was ringing nonstop for probably 3 days mm-hmm. saying, what does this mean for me? Even if they right. weren't one of the yeah. individuals from those countries, because they were scared.
Yeah, just thinking that they are probably going to be the next target.
And there was so much information, so much fear mm-hmm. going around that you had all these clients who are in the process of obtaining their status, already have their green card, even saying, does this mean I'm going to lose my green card, my legal right. permanent residency here? What does this mean? So that was the first piece of the workload increasing. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that, you had probably most of the people I had met just through a consultation in the past 5 years even started calling me back and saying, hey, remember me? Wow. We met 5 years ago. You advised me about my case. Well, I kind of was dragging my feet, but I want to do it now. Because they were scared.
Yes, yes.
And
yes,
so
yes.
even now in my practice, I see a lot of the consultations that are coming in. They knew they had options for a long time mm-hmm. and life just gets in the way a little bit. You know, they mm-hmm. have children, they have jobs, they have all these other things going on and they didn't prioritize this. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, I'm really scared.
Exactly.
I want to handle it now.
Now I need to put this as a priority. I need to take right. care of it right away. Because it is uncertain what's going to happen with their future and the future of their kids and families. That yeah. makes total sense. I mean, look at what's happening now, even on, you know, with social media, Facebook, mm-hmm. for instance. I don't know if this is accurate. I don't know if you heard that supposedly the administration now has access to Facebook accounts of permanent residents and people that became citizens here in the United mm-hmm. States. Is that accurate?
Well, I will say this, that it has been the practice now for some time for the government to look at people's Facebook pages, look at their social media accounts. The level of access, I'm not sure, but I can say from personal experience that I know they look through someone's Facebook account. And I've had it happen to my clients. I speak to all my clients about when you put things, especially my young clients, when you put things on social media, everyone can see them. And you need to be careful with what you're putting up there. Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation I have with every client, regardless mm-hmm. of age, because mm-hmm. you could go to a marriage adjustment interview mm-hmm. and have them bring up, why are there no pictures on your Facebook of you two together?
Right.
Is this a real relationship? You have an Instagram. Where's your husband on your Instagram? Yeah. The more frightening context I think we see it in is accusations of gang membership for young Hispanic males and females. And that's where I've been seeing a lot in removal proceedings mm-hmm. is that the government attorney, the trial attorney, will have printouts from Facebook pages. And that's been going on now for at least 2 years that I have seen.
Unbelievable.
And what we're hearing more and more is that the government will be looking at your social media profiles more and more. So when you mm-hmm. apply for a visa abroad, even a visitor's visa to come here, they're going to start looking through your social media. Who are you friends with? So not just what you post, mm-hmm. but what do your friends post? And that's a scary prospect because I think a lot of individuals don't pay that much attention when they accept friend requests. And you don't know maybe what that person's posting.
Yes, it's going to be even harder now to have access to this country. Basically, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, you know, now we have to be extremely cautious of what we're putting on social media mm-hmm. because the government, the administration is looking into those accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tess, thank you very much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Is there a message that you'd like to give to our community, to the community that is suffering because of the current deportations and actions taken by the administration?
Sure. My number one message would probably be talk to a lawyer, know your rights, understand your situation. Because I meet with so many people that they didn't understand what their rights were. They didn't understand what their options were. Knowing those things empowers you. It's very, very important to understand what's happening, to understand your individual circumstances, and to understand your rights here.
I totally agree with you. Get the information that is crucial for you. Talk to an attorney. In you have rights. Mm-hmm. That's what matters. Even though you don't have a lawful status here in the U.S., you still have rights. So thank you very much, Tess, and hoping that this is not our last interview.
Thank you very much thank for having you.
Me. And this is it for today, my friends. I'm hoping that this interview with Attorney Regan was very informational. We want to advise you that you take the necessary steps to resolve your immigration status. If you have any questions, if you have any concerns, don't hesitate to seek an attorney. Don't hesitate to seek the right information to guide you through the steps that you need to take forward in regards of your immigration status. And if you see yourself in the need of psychotherapy services and you're in the state of Connecticut, don't hesitate to give us a call at 844-912-9832. And if you want to know more about our show, please visit our website at www.ibcpodcast.com. And this is it for today. Hoping that, again, this was of your enjoyment. And we'll be here next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to IBC Podcast at www.ibcpodcast.com. Regarding the subject covered in this episode, it was provided with the understanding that neither the host, co-host, or guest are rendering legal and clinical or other professional information pertinent to your specific case. If you feel you're in the need of support or services, don't hesitate to look for help.